It's dark out, it's cold, it's rainy, we've been traveling for a month, and we're wearing hoods.
Hit it. To the Talkin' Token podcast. I'm Patrick Santino.
And I'm Clifford Vickery.
All right. Clifford, how have you been, dude?
Pretty good. Busy as always. But of course, I found a little bit of time in my week to read chapter 2 of The Hobbit.
Let's just jump into it then. So for this episode, we got some good stuff to talk about, as usual. We'll be talking about the narrator here. We'll dive into some fairy tales and about this company of dwarves we're following. We'll discuss the famous troll scene that takes place in this chapter. And we'll take a couple steps forward in the hero's journey. But before all that, Clifford, why don't you take it away with your Cliff's notes?
So, if you remember, we left the last chapter. Bilbo had gone to bed, very displeased with the behavior of the dwarves in his house. He wakes up to find a messy, empty house with all the signs of a large and hurried breakfast. So he takes his time getting ready in the morning, and all of a sudden Gandalf shows up, scolds him, and rushes him out the door, and he hits the ground running on his way to the Green Dragon Inn in Bywater to meet up with the dwarves who have already begun the journey. Life is good. The journey has, just like that, gotten off to a start. They're all riding ponies, and slowly they get into less populated and darker lands. The weather and the roads get worse, and Bilbo becomes more and more homesick. And one particularly bad night, the group decides to make camp, and they're at this point short on food, dry clothes, and fire, and they see a light off in the distance and decide to investigate. Bilbo is sent ahead. It turns out to be three trolls bickering around a fire and eating mutton. Bilbo foolishly manages to get himself caught, and the entire rest of the dwarf crew to get caught as well. And just before they get eaten, Gandalf manages to save the day, and the trolls are turned to stone. At the end, they plunder the troll cave and get back on their way.
Right on.
What did you think of it? It's sort of the first tribulation of the book.
Yeah, it was. I enjoyed it. Good stuff to talk about here that we'll get into, I think, in the second half of it. But it was a good first adventure. Nice outing. What questions did you have? Just quick questions. You got any of them, like, right off the bat?
Yeah, these are just quick reading questions that I had. Why do the dwarves leave without Bilbo if they're going to wait for him anyways in Bywater?
I think they were just gathering supplies at the Green Dragon.
Getting the ball rolling.
Yeah, some food, packing the food away and everything. Because, they'd already raided all of Bilbo's stores before they left.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how much time elapses in this first part of the journey? Because the book gives kind of a nebulous description where, life is good, the weather's great, and then all of a sudden, it's a bad night. So it sounds like it could be a single day almost, or it could be a month, and we don't really know.
The first read-through, when I ever read it, I thought it was more like a week, like maybe a week into it. But if you look at it, the tea party happens in April, and then there's some reference somewhere in the chapter to something happening, like this was all taking place in May. So about a month has passed by. I also consulted the beloved Atlas of Middle Earth, which has some fine drawings of maps and everything like that. And that's what it was saying as well.
Any questions you had about the chapter?
What is mutton? It's in the title.
Mutton is just a not as good version of lamb. Lamb is baby sheep. Mutton is grown-up sheep.
Bummer.
I think it has the reputation for being cheap and fairly tough. Not a very good meat, but it's, I think, traditional in English and European countryside. So, getting into some deeper questions here. Gandalf sends Bilbo off to meet the dwarves in Bywater. Are we expected to know some Shire geography here? Why isn't the Shire referenced at all? It sounds like it's called Hobbit Lands throughout this whole chapter.
Right, so I don't think he had actually invented the concept of the Shire. That probably doesn't come into Lord of the Rings. But, and even Bywater, that town just happens to be on a lake, so it's something Bywater. Bilbo lives on the hill. So kind of just pull in geographical names that are just their own things so far, which isn't very complicated or whatever. But yeah, the narrator is treating us as if we kind of know the landscape to begin with, and that's kind of deliberate on his part. And it gets into like the whole narrator conversation.
Yeah, it seems like Tolkien's butting in all over the place, just dropping references to places and people and random characteristics. Like, you know, basically he's very intrusive. So what do we make of this? Is there a significance behind it?
So we're dealing with this mythical world or fairy tale world or even almost medieval world at times. And again, we can't really relate to it. So this narrator is kind of, this intrusive narrator is kind of a tactic to just like get us to fit in with the world. He keeps implying that there's stuff outside the story and this whole wider world, and we're only seeing like a small fraction of it. Is kind of the key there, and it almost feels like unfair to us. like we want to know more about it, and eventually that's ends up why we need a sequel to this book, because we did the whole story but we still don't know everything, and we're like, oh, we want more.
So it definitely seems like aspects of this are annoying to us as the reader. Like Tolkien, he's butting in at places and acting like we know a bunch of stuff that we don't necessarily know, but in other ways he is correctly assuming that we have some familiarity. Like, probably everybody has heard of dwarves before, and especially with the generic geographical references, this is similar to like anywhere you go in the world has vague geographic references, like Lakeshore Drive or whatever it may be. So maybe it seems like he's working off of an element of familiarity. Like he's playing off of some common understanding of the world that he's creating.
Right, I think he definitely is, because dwarves are in all sorts of fairy tales, wizards are in all sorts of fairy tales, which you were talking about before, and I think, yeah, this is just supposed to be another fairy tale that fits. I think he's working off the mold of, specifically, to mention one example, but there's others, the Grimm brothers, like the Grimm's fairy tales from out of Germany. That kind of stuff would have been a huge influence on him as a kid.
For those of you who aren't familiar with that, the Grimm brothers are two brothers in Germany in the 1800s who were philologists themselves, like Tolkien. So they're obsessed with the study of words and where they come from, but they kind of wanted to revive or maintain a lot of these old folk tales that they grew up hearing and turn them into literature that would be maintained and preserved for the ages. And in doing so, they kind of outlined so many of the classic fairy tales that we think of.
So we're talking like Rapunzel, Hansel and Gretel, Cinderella, Snow White, Little Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty, Jack and the Beanstalk, Goldilocks, Three Little Pigs, Little Mermaid, Ugly Duckling. Based on what we only know off the first two first chapter and like basically half, and forgetting all of the Middle Earth stuff to come with everything in Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit could probably fit with one of these stories right now.
But now, you were saying earlier that Tolkien was always interested in almost like restoring the glory to a lot of these stories, like bringing them back to an older version
right.
of themselves.
That was also what the Grimm brothers were interested in. By the time the Grimm brothers got to these stories, they're just like the little kids' bedtime stories that we knew. The Grimm brothers were about a generation before Tolkien, so we're talking middle of the 1800s. And so, yeah, they wanted to preserve all these stories because they knew, like, yeah, they're only kid stories now, but these were, these used to be like actual mythology, like all these dwarves and everything. Like it used to, I'll go back to kind of like the Norse gods with Odin and Thor and Loki and all the dwarves that are in those and all the magical, other magical creatures like Mants and everything like that. But by the time they get to it, they preserve what they can, which are basically these fairy tales. But the problem with these fairy tales is you can maybe make the case that they all take place in the same world, or maybe it's our world, but there's just no crossover in between them. All the stories are standalone. They just don't interact with each other, which is kind of lame.
Okay. So you're saying Tolkien's trying to take it a step further, basically.
Yeah, he does.
He's trying to wind these back even further, remove them from their bedtime fairy tale context, and stitch them together into a larger epic.
Right. So this whole company of dwarves, we got the 13 dwarves. Can you name them off the top of your head? Dude, you're pulling out the book. We're not doing this. Forget it.
Okay. 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 Off the top of my head, I could tell you, since we got a bunch of rhyming ones, we got Philly and Killy, Oin and Gloin, Biffer, Bofer, and Bomber, and Thorin, and I'm blanking. That's all I got.
You forgot.
Who'd I miss?
Dwalin Balin. Did you say Ori Nori Dori?
No.
Yeah, that's what you forgot.
You're correct. All right. Dwalin Balin, Ori Nori Dori.
Anyways, though. So Tolkien didn't actually come up with those names himself. Maybe he did with a couple of them. But he was actually doing what we were just saying. He actually got this from a list of names that are in the Edda, which is the... Well, Clifford, why don't you tell us? You actually know more about this one than me.
The Edda is a collection of stories that is basically like the definitive assembly of Norse mythology. There's the Elder and the Younger Edda. One is considered the Poetic Edda and one the Prose Edda. And the version that happened to survive to the present day, or like kind of the one surviving copy, was from Iceland. But it was a collection of stories that were relevant all across Scandinavia and Northern Europe. And so there's a lot of overlap between them. But effectively, it's like the Norse Bible.
So one little section in there is there's this thing called the Dvergatal, which is the tally, which translates to the tally of the dwarves. And it's just a list of a company of dwarves. And at least 9 of the 13 dwarves that we know are on that list. What's also interesting is Gandalf is on that list, and even the equivalent of the name Oakenshield is on that list.
Interesting. That's so Thorin's last name, and then so you're saying that Tolkien lifted Gandalf's name from a list of dwarves?
Right. Well, I mean, let's just talk about this list a little bit more first, though. He's basically going back and reconstructing what the Grimm brothers were trying to save. Like, he had the ancient mythological source, and now he kind of just got the idea, maybe I'll actually write a story of what this company of dwarves were doing. Which is, you know, the Grimm brothers didn't go and make artificial stories themselves like what Tolkien's doing here, but they were preserving the stuff, and that's the kind of stuff that they knew they lost and they wanted to find again. And it's only preserved in the fairy tales. But now Tolkien is going beyond that and making basically an artificial fairy tale using that list.
Right. Interesting.
And so, yeah, so like you were just saying, though, Gandalf's on that list. I mean, obviously in this story, Gandalf's not a dwarf. he's a wizard. Now, he's on that list because Tolkien would have translated Gandalf into, based on the language, into elf staff. So that would imply not necessarily that he's actually an elf, but if you're an elf, you're clearly not a dwarf.
He's got more to do with elves than dwarves.
Right, yes. And the staff, okay. The staff is the traditional tool of a wizard in close to everything.
So what do we think about these dwarves? Like, how does their representation in The Hobbit relate to what you're talking about? Like, this tally of dwarves and the Edda and other mythologies that Tolkien's referencing? And how does it play into the story?
based on what we know about this list and kind of the song from the last episode, it kind of paints the dwarves not quite at like this Snow White fairy tale level of cute little colorfully dressed gold miners. I mean, there's more to them. They're more remorseless or greedy, or they want revenge. Like, they seek revenge on this dragon, basically.
Which we know from the last chapter, their agenda to return home and get their gold back.
Yeah. It also says in some of Tom Shippey's notes, there's other scenes in the Edda where the dwarves are completely ruthless and, you know, battle-hardened kind of guys, and they're... And he actually uses kind of those things as his main inspiration for his dwarves.
So we've been seeing the dwarves as the good guys so far. Or at least Bilbo's the good guy and he's traveling alongside the dwarves. Are they meant to be more of kind of like a gray tone, like not black or white, but kind of a mixed, convoluted character group?
Well, we were talking before too how... yeah, they want their home back, but it's more so the gold. I think they're fairly materialistic, you say. And I think at this point in our society, that's somewhat frowned upon usually.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd still agree with that today, too.
Yeah, I mean, just those descriptors make them, like, those are negative connotations nowadays. But so far, I think it's pretty easy to interpret the dwarf story so far in The Hobbit as, like, for the most part, positive. Like, they're looking for justice.
Yeah, they're looking for justice.
Not revenge.
Bilbo is a good guy. He's our main character. I don't know if we're really rooting for him yet, because, I mean, we only have a chapter of knowing him, but we can relate to him. Gandalf seems like a good guy, so Gandalf wants to help these people out. So I'd say, yeah, you get behind the dwarves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Still more to learn, I think. So, shall we get into the iconic early first adventure?
Yeah. So, when they realize there's something going on up ahead, Thorin sends Bilbo, since he's the burglar, up ahead to inspect. Is Thorin sending Bilbo to have Bilbo prove his worth, or is Thorin just kind of being a coward here?
I think that's a really good question. I think... I'm going to give Thorin the benefit of the doubt at this point and say it's more so proving the worth, though clearly he probably doesn't want to go himself or risk any of the dwarves either. But,
right.
I mean, obviously we're talking about the troll scene that's coming up here. And, I mean, those dwarves all end up getting captured by the trolls, and of that, Thorin actually puts up a fairly badass fight. So I'd say it's not like he was... be scared to go.
But this whole scene struck me as a little bit weird. Like, it's a place where I felt like the narrator was kind of had an agenda here, and we were along for the ride. But certain things don't totally make sense to me. Like this particular part felt like it was more of a children's tale than other parts of the book.
I agree.
So, like, they send Bilbo ahead. He gets captured, and then the dwarves get sent one by one, and each one gets captured as they show up out of the forest. It just seems like if they had all showed up at once, they would have put up a fight. But instead, they walked in like lame ducks and got captured.
I think the children's story part is right here. I mean, Bilbo's words of advice, hoot twice like a barn owl and once like a screech owl if you need help. It's like, okay, this is bound to fail. And then, yeah, like you said, they're walking in one by one. Obviously, you strengthen numbers. Like we're saying, though, this is a kid's story. I don't think we should terribly overanalyze it. I think this is just kind of a fun little first adventure outing. You know, they're going to do bad the first time. They're going to grow as they go. I mean, maybe that's a spoiler.
I suppose so. But also, it was kind of interesting that Bilbo seemed like he felt like he had to steal something just for the sake of stealing something without really knowing what he should take or why. So he decides to go for the wallet, which turns out it can talk, which is kind of stupid.
Yeah, I mean, so we have to remember too, this is just a standalone story at this point when he's writing it or like telling it to his children. And I agree. I can't really, other than that, I can't really defend why a troll's wallet would be talking. I mean, it's kind of a stupid concept, okay, in my opinion. I'm also very thankful that this whole idea, yeah, I'm going to steal his wallet, that'll really help us when we're starving and wet and cold. And I'm glad that one of the drawers, Bomber, pointed out after this whole thing, like, oh, pickpocketing, what were you thinking, Bilbo? That's a stupid idea. So I'm glad there was even justice within the story that this is stupid. But again, kids' book, so let's not overanalyze it here.
Right. And then Gandalf, the last note on that, Gandalf shows up at the end and uses his cleverness to save the day. It felt like, you know, Gandalf just showed up at exactly the right moment. Like, it's a lot of luck.
Well, he's a wizard. I don't really question a wizard's movements kind of thing. I mean, he's kind of like the overarching guy who's going to help him see this quest through at this point. I mean, you can kind of just trust him to get you through whatever you're facing, I'd say. I don't know. Let's talk about the trolls a little bit, though. What'd you think of them? They were kind of funny.
They were... I mean,
did you know how to read their accent?
I assumed that it was just kind of like a dirty accent. I don't know if I had a specific voice in my mind when I was reading it.
Right, so they probably would have sounded something like this.
Goes, then at least speak English. All right, my son. I'd quite wait with a cracking jury, my old China.
Are you telling pork pies and a bag of trout? Because if you are feeling quicky, why not just have a J. Arthur?
What, Billy? No, mates.
So right, you.
Don't you remember the Crembo din we had with the grotty Scotchman?
Oh, the one that was all sixes and sevens.
Yeah, she was a travelling stripe, but a Morris dancer lived up the apples and pears.
Yeah, she was the barrister that became Bobby in a lorry.
Good old Austin Powers. Nice. So they would have so that accents, like Michael Caine's kind of accent there, I don't know so much about Austin Powers' goofy one, but but Michael Caine, that's called the Cockney accent, and yeah, you're saying it's was notoriously lower class kind of stuff and vulgar. We speak it in West End, wherever that is in London.
Okay. It seems like the trolls are just like intentionally vulgar characters. Like, he's kind of, the only thing they've got going for them is the fact that they're big, but they seem like they're stupid, and they've got this accent that implies that they're kind of low class. And
yeah, and I think like maybe there's a couple individual touches just to the story, but overall that kind of thing would fit in with any sort of fairy tale as well.
Right. They're like clearly just the negative force. They're the challenge.
And obviously we don't like them. We don't feel any sort of affection for them in any way whatsoever.
And they are a little bit of comic relief, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, I could totally see his kids cracking up at this. But yeah, and so, you know, it's their fighting that ends up being their downfall as well.
And their stupidity, gullibility.
One of the things evil never has going for it, or always works against evil, is itself, and that they're usually feuds and everything like that, which is probably a subtle detail that he's bringing up. And it ends up failing with, they're outsmarted by Gandalf, because why?
Because Gandalf shows up and basically makes voices in the woods that they assume to be each other and keeps the bickering going until the sun comes up, at which point they all turn to stone.
So, I'll ask you, Clifford, did you know that trolls turn to stone at dawn?
No, that caught me by surprise.
Caught me by surprise, but the narrator treated us completely as if we all knew that. I think he literally says, of course, somewhere in there.
It's like he's teasing us.
Right, so I mean, again, this is the intrusive narrator, and this is a way of introducing us into the story. He's just saying stuff that's just so obvious, and it's like, no, dude. Like, we almost feel dumb that we don't know it, but it's like, well, nobody actually knows that, like, if you ever thought that was not a common thing. Just a fun note too, this actually probably came from, he probably got the inspiration because either Thor or Odin in Norse mythology, they played the same trick on a dwarf as opposed to a troll. They played the same trick on a dwarf as Gandalf played on the trolls here at sunrise. Interesting. Yeah, they chatted off a dwarf's ear, and then at sunrise, dwarf turned to stone.
So is there evidence for that, or is there background for dwarves turning to stone?
Yeah, I don't know. That almost imply that dwarves, because this is Thor and Odin, who we usually consider good guys, doing that to a dwarf. So maybe the dwarves were evil in that story.
Interesting.
I think in Norse mythology, they could go either way.
More neutral, yeah.
I mean, we're considering the dwarves kind of good guys right now because they're on our side. But right. By our side, I mean Bilbo and Gandalf, because Gandalf seems like a good guy. Bilbo
right.
is our main character. But yeah.
Right.
I don't know. Overall, though, it seems when Gandalf's not around, the party's struggling.
Yeah.
They probably struck out their first bat here.
Yeah. Thorin's clearly the leader, but he, you know, hasn't managed to lead them all that well so far. And they don't have a lot of talent going for him, it seems.
Thorin put up a good fight, though.
He put up a good fight as an individual fighting, right? He wasn't leading a team.
No, he wasn't leading a team. But Thorin's, at this point, he's the only dwarf we can actually distinguish as well. All the other ones just seem like they're just one of the dwarves. Thorin, he's the leader because he's royal. And then I think he actually started to prove himself in this, that he's the best fighter of them. So he starts to actually have some sort of character, whereas the other 12 are just a group of 12, nothing distinguishing them yet.
Right, right. We learned that, too, I think Keeley and Philippe know how to start fires, although they couldn't start a fire on the rainy night.
No, that was Oin and Gloin.
Oh, Oin and Gloin, rather. Keeley and Philippe.
Well, we know what they are because we read a little bit ahead, but...
I mean, they're the we'll get to ones, that but... scene. I can be your hero, baby. There goes my hero. Watch him as he goes. I'm a hero. He's larger than life. Larger than life. This reminds us that we are on the hero's journey. Patrick, what step of the hero's journey have we reached?
So, we have now reached step 2, refusal of the call. This step is pretty quick in this book, but it was definitely there. It was definitely there.
Explain it a little bit. What does refusal of the call involve?
The refusal is a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest. Some people straight up refuse, and that's the end of the story. That's the end of their hero's journey. They just live a regular life.
Well, they're no hero. It's just a journey.
They now cut themselves off from being heroes. Uh-huh. Some people refuse, but then they go back and are like, yeah, okay, fine. I'll they get on board. Some people refuse, and that leads to basically a negative route to get them on board to go on the journey. Like, their choosing to say no leads to negative consequences that force them onto the journey anyways.
Like a family member gets killed or something like that.
You mentioned that, Clifford. That leads to our classic example that we will run till we can't run it anymore of Star Wars Episode 4. Luke meets Obi-Wan, and then Obi-Wan's like, dude, Luke, I'm really old. Like, I'm going to need your help with this on this super grand adventure to save this princess lady or whatever. And Luke's all like, nah, man, I'm the son of a farmer, you know? I have to be here for some reason, you know? Or maybe he's just intimidated. Right. Maybe Luke was just intimidated and daunted or whatever, but he's just like, no way. Like, whoa, I cannot do this. And so he actually runs away right away and goes home to find his aunt and uncle are killed. So now he has nothing left, to the point where he's like, fine. And he's so pissed, he's just like, yeah, all right, let's do it. I'll go for this. He gets behind it. Kung Fu Panda. Poe, he's already been chosen as the Dragon Warrior, but he's getting bullied by all the people because it's just like, dude, you're fat. You're not supposed to be here. You have no athletic skill whatsoever, including by his teacher, to the point where, maybe I should leave or whatever. But all of a sudden, the plot thickens to the point where Poe is their last hope.
Well, yeah, so it seems like certain stories like Kung Fu Panda, that's a pretty epic transition. Like, the hero really is down in the dumps. I was like, no, I can't do this. I wasn't cut out for this. But a lot of stories, this step goes really fast. Like, it's a moment of hesitation before they totally jump on board.
Here, it was definitely fast because Bilbo woke up and he was like, cool. I am happy that was all a dream, or at the very least, they just left without me. Good. I don't have to do this. But it's also important to note that, cool, he was relieved. He was relieved. I think that's pretty key word. He was relieved that he didn't have to do this, but there's also a twinge of him that's like, maybe I missed out on something. And then all of a sudden, Gandalf just pops in his window. He's like, dude, you're late. You gotta go. And so maybe you could think Gandalf shoo him out, but I think it's important to note that Bilbo is definitely like, yeah, you know what? I should do this. I gotta go do this.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost as if his refusal of the call was the night before, but he goes to bed reluctant.
Yeah, but I don't think we're going to do two steps in the first episode. So, yeah. But, yeah, possibly. I think the refusal, yeah, was probably there, but then what I'd also say is part of this step of, like, actually, like, fine, I'll go on this, was in this chapter. There's some times where it's like, man, I really think I should do something, and I, like, gear up for it. I'm just like, yeah, I should do this. And then maybe I don't. Maybe I'm too lazy. Maybe I chicken out or something. But then if a second chance arises, I usually don't even think about it. I'm usually like, oh, I think it's fate that I should just do this. Like, I'm meant to go do this. And so, like, I'll usually be more on board.
At that point, it's set in.
Yeah, I'm more on board with it to just jump in after that with, like, a second prompting.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it's like as soon as you feel regret about something, you're way more likely to jump at the opportunity the next time around. But we've got another step on the hero's journey in this chapter, because so much happened. Hit us, Patrick.
All right, so we also hit step three in this. Maybe we hit this in chapter one, but just for chronology's sake of the actual steps themselves, we're going to do it here. I also haven't actually read into that too much yet, or I forget, but I don't know if we actually have to do all these steps in order. We're going to try to.
Hmm.
And of course, they basically go in order, but I feel like you could somewhat go out of order. Slightly. Mm-hmm. Because in this mm-hmm. one, the third step, of course, is supernatural aid. Specifically and commonly, that's the meeting of a mentor. The first encounter of the hero's journey is with a protective figure, often an old crone, an old man, who provides the adventure with amulets. Usually they meet some sort of guiding figure. Maybe they're not really even a guide for the whole thing. Maybe it's just like an old lady on the road who gives them like some treasure that'll really help them out. Or maybe it's some old man who is willing to guide them or something. Or maybe it's a fairy godmother. That's very common.
So we get, there's kind of this recurring theme of somebody humble and wise.
Yeah, wise probably because of their age. Maybe the humble as well.
And they're sort of unassuming, but they're able to offer very useful advice.
Right. And so sometimes the person goes with them. Sometimes they only give them, like, tools that'll help them on their journey.
Right. Point them in the right direction.
Yeah, so in Star Wars, this would be, like, Obi-Wan. Not only is Obi-Wan going to actually end up guiding Luke, but he also gives him his dad's old lightsaber as well. So, I mean, that's a tool that Luke's going to use throughout this thing. But then, yeah, Obi-Wan's like, all right, let me guide you. Let me train you up throughout this whole process here. Another example that came to my head, if we're going to go to Dante's Divine Comedy, but this is the story where the guy goes through, Dante himself goes through hell, and then he walks up through purgatory and through heaven and sees it all, and like it's very poetic, beloved. And the first person he meets is Virgil, who's an ancient poet himself, and he's gonna lead Dante through hell and be his guide as well.
Yeah, the Odyssey, which uses a lot of these. It doesn't fit perfectly with all the steps, but this is a pretty good one, because throughout the Odyssey, or at the beginning of the Odyssey, Odysseus is on his way home from the Trojan War. He's sailing with his crew. A bunch of the gods decide that they're going to screw him over. But Athena, who's sort of the warrior goddess of wisdom and war, I think, she decides that she's going to be sort of a guardian angel for him. So she's looking out for him throughout the story and impacts a few key situations. And so the first time that she is introduced to the story, that's supernatural aid coming to Odysseus.
Yeah, I think she kind of works as like the fairy godmother kind of thing, though she wouldn't appear old or anything. But obviously fairy godmother, look no further than the Cinderella.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in ours, our guide is none other than
Gandalf. So is there, obviously there's a lot of historical background for the hero's journey, but do we have any, what do we know about Gandalf, and like where is his character coming from?
Again, you know, we're going to do this show with close to no spoilers of all the stuff. So, I mean, we're only going to talk about Gandalf here based on what we know. The word means elf staff on that Norse list. Tolkien took that not to mean an elf, but to mean not a dwarf, and then staff means he's a wizard. Mm-hmm. So far, he's kind of just been a pretty run-of-the-mill wizard. Seems to fit usual descriptions. It's not like it's some like society thing like in Harry Potter, but I mean they're good with magic, and like they, you know, Bilbo said he liked his fireworks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean he seems to be wise and you can trust his judgment.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've read, you might think maybe he's based off Merlin from like the King Arthur stories. Maybe he was, okay. But I think Tolkien's main inspiration would have been Odin, again from Norse mythology, because Odin, he was the head of the gods and everything, but lots of times he would disguise himself as a hooded, one-eyed old man walking around.
So he's the patriarch, kind of like Zeus, but
yeah,
probably a little bit less cocky than Zeus.
And he would disguise himself and walk around the world of men just to kind of get to know him and everything, because he knew these would be warriors he'd recruit later on throughout eternity. He'd be much more unassuming than than the power he actually has, right, when he would go in disguise.
It's an interesting concept, this like recurring theme of somebody with supernatural powers or immortality or whatever it may be, kind of godlike characteristics, taking on masking themselves as an innocent old man or a beggar or something as a way to observe the people. It feels a bit different from like Christian style reincarnation, God in the flesh situation. Like it feels, yeah, it just has, is a different aspect, but it's a recurring theme nevertheless.
Yeah, you might get in towards like the kind of like the Greek hospitality thing. Greeks were always super nice to strangers because they never knew when they were possibly serving a god.
Okay.
So they always welcome strangers in their house. Plus, you know, strangers need it because, I mean, back then it's not like they had like a Walmart or something to go pick up some food whenever they were in their most dire need. You know,
it's like the anonymity is coded into the culture as a way to maintain respect.
I think hopefully we can talk about this kind of hospitality stuff at some other point. But okay. I think we did the job here for today.
Der Burgeist?
Oh, right. Oh, shoot. Yeah, you're right. All right, we got to hit this. Yeah, so Tolkien didn't actually travel much, but when he was 14 years old, he went on a pretty epic backpacking trip to Switzerland with, I think, his brother and some sort of relative.
Uh-huh.
And he brought back a postcard of this old man. It's called Der Burgeist is the picture on front of it, and it's a mountain. It's called the Mountain Spirit. Is what that would translate to. It's by some German artist or whatever, but he wrote on the back of it, Origin of Gandalf. And you can look up the picture. I mean, it's pretty cool. It looks like Gandalf. He's got the wide-brimmed hat, white beard, long cloak. Now, the cloak's red, which I thought was kind of weird, but then he's a white fawn is nuzzling up to him. And there's a bunch of mountains in the distance.
Mm-hmm. So he's sort of old man of the woods, at one with nature.
Yeah. I'd say that's about what we know of Gandalf. I'm sure we'll talk about him more.
So
why don't we do some housekeeping stuff? We still haven't released, by the time we're recording this, we still haven't released any episodes yet. But if you have any questions for us, we'd love questions. We'll probably start either answering them in shows. Maybe we'll do like a whole separate show of just questions. We have an email at talkingtolkienpodcast@gmail.com. Clifford has graciously set up our Instagram, which is also Talking Tolkien Podcast. Now, I set up our Twitter, and I screwed up. I just made it very quickly without like really looking at anything. So our Twitter handle is @TolkienTalking, as opposed to Talking Tolkien. But yeah, @TolkienTalking. Please follow us. So far, I've just been shouting out anybody that does and making some corny reference with it, which cracks me up, but I don't know. We should be posting some pretty good stuff on Instagram. Twitter, I mean, it's good for updates. I'll try to post like articles that are cool too. We'll have a Facebook page. We haven't, at the time of this, we haven't made it yet. And then check our website, which is also, it'll be out by the time this is out. Also, please write us a review, because funniest, wittiest, heartwarmingest reviews will be read on here and prizes will be awarded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anything else, Clifford?
Nothing on my side.
Cool. I think that'll about do it.
We'll catch you next time for episode 3 of the Talking Tolkien Podcast. Thanks, y'all.